home, I was in a lot of pain. I couldn't sleep, so I went to hospital and I got checked. After I was discharged, I wanted to find out what happened with the police, so I called to find out. And they said, your case is a theft case and I'll be going to court. I tried to explain the situation and told him that he hit and strangled me. I know in Denmark that's a crime. They replied, no, well, you did try to take his property. I replied, no, I was protecting the Quran. The man that hit me knew I am Muslim because he was shouting, she's Muslim, laughing. He knew I wasn't trying to steal the Quran and I'm trying to protect it. But he had to find a way, anyway, to get himself out so he doesn't get arrested. So he put the blame on me, shouting that I am stealing his property. I hope the Quran burnings will stop and all the Arab and Muslim countries come together and make sure to protect the Quran. We must all stand together. I've had a lot of Arab television coverage and support from Arab and Muslim countries. This has made me stronger for when I go to court, and I will hold my head up high and be strong because I stood up for something I love and believe in. It really is a good feeling to know I have so many people behind me supporting what I have done. And if I ever see the Quran being burnt, I will do the same thing again and will forever protect the Quran. Even if it was up in flames, I will always do my best to put it out.
Well, joining us today in the studio to talk about these acts of resistance against the desecration of the Holy Quran, we have Roja Mohammed Saleh, who is the editor of the Muslim news platform Five Pillars, and joining us on Skype from Copenhagen, we have Brother Murtada Al-Shawi, who boasts a master's in Middle Eastern studies in the University of Copenhagen and has an interest in the ongoing formation of the Danish Muslims' identity. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. Murtada, I'm going to speak to you first of all. Just tell me, what has it been like living in Denmark as a Muslim while these horrific acts of desecration are taking place?
Well, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, to start off, it has been until now a very joyful way of living here in Denmark. We are known for our welfare, we are known for our freedoms. And we are participating as we have, we enjoy these goods. We are also participating in developing Denmark as a nation. But it has been very painful. It has been shameful seeing the extremists, racists misuse and hijack the freedom of speech that we have in Denmark and that we enjoy. And it has been a very painful situation to be a Danish citizen, seeing the pressure from outside pushing politicians to take action on the legislative way of forbidding these burnings.
Now, I also want to ask you, while I have you, about the general public opinion on Quran burnings in Denmark especially. We're seeing this happen more and more, but what does the public of Denmark actually think? Do they support these Quran burnings?
So based on our opinions as Danish Muslims, we see that our fellow citizens are different in their opinions. Some of them have not... most of them have not seen this way of criticism. In Denmark, we have the freedom of speech. We are known of not having any kind of boundaries or limits to give our opinions, and that's very healthy, in my opinion. But at the same time, we have been known for giving out our opinions and criticism based on a solution, based on an ideology, an understanding. But this way, this new phenomenon, this negative way of expression has not been precedented before the cartoons in 2006 and before the burnings of the Quran. So based on our understanding, when we talk personally to our colleagues, our neighbors, most of them are not happy with this negative way of criticism and burning your way through misunderstandings and disagreement with others.
Okay, Roshan, let me come to you on this because the brother in Copenhagen mentioned the freedom of speech argument. That's something which we hear time and again, particularly from the far right, who want to keep these Islamophobic acts going and keep their freedom to do so. Just tell me, the freedom of speech argument, does it make sense to you or is it hypocritical there?
No, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, I think we have to acknowledge that there are limits to freedom of speech in any society, any civilized society, especially one which has a multicultural element, because people have different ideas, they've got to rub along together, and therefore there has to be some kind of limits to offence. So I would draw those limits, obviously, at violence, calls for violence. But also, I think there are some things that are so sacred, like, for example, you know, for Jews, it would be the Torah. For us, it's the Quran. You know, just as we should never, you know, even countenance burning a Torah, you know, because that is offensive to Jews and could spark off a reaction which could turn violent, the same thing should be the case for the Quran. But I do think there's a double standard, especially in places like Sweden and Denmark and all across Europe, in that they wouldn't, you know, burn a Torah. That wouldn't happen, and there'd be consequences at an official level if it did, whereas it seems as though for Muslims we're kind of fair game.
It does feel that way. I mean, I know Quds al-Samarai, who did this brave act to defend the Quran from right-wingers, she was the one arrested in the end. Even though they actually put their hands on her, she was the one who faces a day in court as a result of that.
Well, the police gave the extremists the Quran back to desecrate, didn't they? They literally handed the Holy Quran back to these extremists so that they could desecrate it.
And can you imagine if they did the same for a Torah, as you said, or if they had the word F, Judaism, written on a banner behind them? I'm sure this would be considered racism and hate speech, and they would be the ones facing a day in court as a result of that. Brother Murtada, let me come back to you. I want to ask you about this freedom of speech debate. I'm sure it's been raised in Denmark as well, perhaps in press circles as well. Just tell me, what's the Danish view on this? Do they understand why Muslims would be so upset to see the Quran desecrated like this?
So, of course, this situation that we are in is not positive at all. But at the same time, there is a very good positive side of it. I mean, there is some kind of a dynamic that we as Danish Muslims, as a Danish society, have never seen before. There is an internal discussion about the freedom of speech. Yesterday, I was in a radio program with two other Danish Muslims talking about the boundaries of freedom of speech. Do we have such boundaries? In Denmark, we have lights who control our way of traffic, using the traffic. We have other kind of boundaries for the freedom of speech, so it's not absolute. And we also talked about and touched about upon the subject of the society and how it changed. We have a multicultural society, maybe in the UK, in Sweden, in Germany, you have had a longer history. But in Denmark, it's fairly new. In the recent four decades, it's very new that people with different hair color and skin color, such as myself, we call ourselves Danes. And this is something that the normal Danish citizen should accept, that our society has changed. It has to accommodate, and the freedom of speech has to be open to accommodate all the different society layers, the society identities. And this is something that we internally in Denmark are right now talking about in a very big space. And I think that is a very, very healthy discussion. So we know that the society is not as it was three, four decades ago. And we need to accommodate that in our constitution, in our institutions, in our media even, so that Muslims are not looked at as foreigners, but as part of society.
Well, as I said earlier on, there have been huge protests in virtually all Muslim-majority nations, as well as other action against the desecration of our beloved holy book.
The desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden and Denmark has provoked a furious reaction in Muslim-majority nations, from Iran to Indian-controlled Kashmir to Palestine and Iraq and beyond.
We cannot tolerate the desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden. We condemn it in the strongest possible words.
We as Muslims living in the East, we feel very much, you know, we feel sad about the fact that copies of Holy Quran have been burned. Quran is very dear to us, and that is the reason we are protesting.
Meanwhile, in Iraq, on the day of Ashura, Iraqis marched to defend the holy book.
In this march, we condemn the Swedish government for allowing these people to burn our book, the Book of Allah, the Holy Quran. It is the book that was given to our Prophet Muhammad.
These huge demonstrations around the Muslim world have been backed up by diplomatic action and economic boycotts. Acts of resistance, which have forced the Swedish and Danish authorities to seriously consider their stance on allowing Quran burnings.
Well, let's come back to the discussion now. Obviously, things remain very tense. The public feeling among Muslims is very angry right now, I have to say. Brother Murtada, let me ask you about how Muslims in Denmark have been reacting to this, because our natural instinct is to get very angry. But we are ambassadors of the religion of Islam, of course. How can we use Islam to positively respond to these horrific acts which cause so much offense?
Thank you very much for this great question. And I think even the Danish media, we have had several journalists the recent days asking exactly the same question. What has been a difference compared to before? Why can Danish Muslims not just ignore the fact that some idiots, they call them idiots, burn the Quran? And our response has been, yes, we have tried that. I mean, of course, it is something that touches our hearts, seeing something as dear on our hearts as the Holy Quran, which we read five times a day, being desecrated, being criticized by being burned, and not by subjective criticism, which is very, very normal within the Danish society and the Muslim world in general. But this way of criticism has not been taken lightly. And we as Danish Muslims, we try to bring this perspective through the Danish media, through the international media, to talk to our fellow people of faith that we need to be ambassadors of Islam. We need to show what the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his holy household showed of mercy, of understanding, of a talking dialogue, even with those who are enemies of Islam and these symbols. So it is a kind of work that we need to do on ourselves as Muslims in general, and being true ambassadors with the challenges that we have. We are still, we say that always all the time to the media, that we as Danish Muslims are people of blood and meat. So we are people who have feeling. We cannot just be expected to ignore such heinous acts, which are unethical and unrespectful. So it is a process.
Well, thank you. Roshan, I want to come back to you as well with a similar question, how Muslims should respond to this, because I have heard some Muslims say that, you know, if you respond to these types of desecrations, it gives them publicity and encourages them to continue doing so. But then, I mean, surely we can't just sit back and do nothing. We have to apply some pressure here. So what do you make of this?
Yes, I mean, it's a balance, but I think that, you know, these desecrations they've become so viral that we can't ignore it anymore. And, you know, we have to defend our religion, our deen, our prophet, our honour. You know, it's something that we have to do. It's a question of how do we do it effectively. And I think I noticed the comments from both the Swedish and the Danish authorities, the prime ministers, respective prime ministers, and they're obviously thinking of banning these Quran burnings because of the reaction that has taken place. If it weren't for the massive protests around the Muslim world, if it weren't for the threat of sanctions, the threat of boycotts of Swedish and Danish businesses, the expulsion of ambassadors, etc., the popular mobilization, if it wasn't for that, they wouldn't be saying this. And it's important that we don't assume that we've won either. The pressure has to be kept on. But they were talking about, you know, the threats to Swedish and Danish businesses, to you know, Denmark and Sweden's international reputation. Obviously, Sweden wants to join NATO, so Turkey potentially could stop that even at this stage. It seems to have kind of given up that card, but they haven't got in there yet. So I think the pressure needs to be kept on. Also, I mean, God forbid something might happen as well, because they're talking about the security situation. They feel that, you know, these acts are so incendiary that there might be a violent reaction from Muslims. Now, God forbid that happens, but we know that there are idiots in every community and people that do bad things in every community. So I think the Swedish authorities are generally concerned that if this happens, there will be some kind of violent reaction, a terrorist attack or something like that. And, you know, obviously we all hope that doesn't, hope and pray that that doesn't happen, but they are creating the environment for something like that to happen. I think that's one reason why the Danish and the Swedish authorities need to address this.
For sure. And I think one way that this has kind of worked in our favour in a way is because it's a PR win for the Muslim world. The fact is that the UN, for example, has taken our side on this issue. The Pope, the highest authority in the Catholic Church, has also come and defended Muslims on this issue. So it makes the Western world, the supporters of this so-called freedom of speech, look like a huge minority that no one else supports globally.
And very briefly, I think this is also a great dawah opportunity for us, you know, and I had an idea of kind of, you know, translating Qurans into Danish and Swedish, mass producing them, giving them out for free. This is something that Muslims can crowdfund. So it's a great opportunity for us to present the true teachings of Islam to non-Muslims in these countries.
Brother Murtada, let me bring you in before the show ends. We haven't got a lot of time left, but just tell me, do you actually think that Denmark and Sweden will actually eventually ban these horrific acts? Is there a real possibility of that, or is it just talk?
There is a real possibility, both due to the international scenario of the war in Ukraine. This has gotten our Minister of Foreign Affairs to call upon the first shot of getting a ban on the burning of Qurans. His suggestion was only limited to the banning in front of embassies, and that was under big criticism from us as Danish Muslims and the Danish society in general, because this will not solve the problem from the root. So we have been pushing towards, and we are seeing a lot of other voices from non-Muslims taking upon themselves this push and support to get a ban and reactivate the paragraph of blasphemy that which we already have in our constitution, has been deactivated in 2017. So there are grounds of legislation to stop this desecration, and at the same time stop the boycott, stop the there are, of course, some international political pressure from the OEC countries, from in order also to gain support for the war in Ukraine. So there are many different factors that play a role in this legislation. And yes, there is a very big hope, as we see it in our discussions, that the Danish media is focusing a lot about it, the political sphere is talking about it, and we are hoping that we can push towards getting such legislation.
Well, unfortunately, we have reached the end of the show. So to you, Roshan, for joining me in the studio, thank you for your time. And Brother Murtada in Copenhagen, thank you so much. But I will end the show by saying that all Muslims love the Quran. That's obvious. But how many of us can honestly say we've actually engaged in self-sacrifice and hardship in order to defend the honor of our beliefs? Quds al-Samara'i certainly now can. Instinctively, upon seeing the Quran being desecrated, she risked her own freedom, well-being, and even safety to save the Quran from these two right-wing thugs who, as you saw from the footage earlier on, have absolutely no issue with laying their hands on a defenseless woman. Quds did what so many Muslims claim they would do in a similar situation, but quite rarely ever actually follow through. Let this be a reminder to all of us to remain loyal to our beliefs and always be ready to sacrifice our own comforts in this temporary life in order to struggle for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Okay, that's all the time we have for this edition of the show, unfortunately. But thank you to our guests and thank you at home. Join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. But for now, salamu alaikum.
a diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration plans to issue an executive order restricting investment in sensitive technologies in China this week. The news, which came shortly before the U.S. Commerce Secretary's reported China visit, is a flood pressure tactic repeatedly used by the U.S. regime, but it will fail again, as Chinese experts believe. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times noted, as the United States is intensifying technology blockade to contain China, which is getting increasingly ineffective, the reported investment restriction is against economic norms that will trigger a stronger backlash from American corporate investors and dent Biden's re-election chance, experts say. The executive order would restrict U.S. investment in China in high-tech sectors such as artificial intelligence, semiconductor chips, and quantum computing. Three people familiar with the matter told Nikkei Asia. The investment restrictions, which have been postponed on several occasions and could be delayed again, are not expected to take effect right away, according to Reuters. The news comes as Bloomberg reported that U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo is planning to visit China in late August. According to Reuters, the topic also came up last month during U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's meeting with Chinese officials. The recent series of visits by senior U.S. officials to China is not simply a case of Washington's efforts to ease bilateral tensions, as some Western media reports claim. Zhao Lingyun, an expert at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences in Beijing, told the Global Times recently. Zhao said the news intentionally leaked in order to put pressure on China on the eve of meetings between Chinese and U.S. officials in a frequently used U.S. political tactic to win a prior advantage. But the petty move won't force China to comply with arbitrary demands. Experts say issuing a clumsy administrative order that goes against economic principles is another flawed move aimed at decoupling and breaking industrial supply chains and weaponizing economic and trade issues. Zhao says the plan to restrict investment in the technology sector obviously creates great uncertainty and risks for U.S. corporate investors. If U.S. President Joe Biden chooses to harm the interests of U.S. companies in such a clumsy way using executive orders, his re-election prospects will suffer. In response to questions about the reported plan, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Mao Ning said earlier that China opposes the U.S. politicizing and weaponizing trade and technology issues. It is in no one's interest to place arbitrary curbs on normal technology cooperation and trade. violate the principles of the market economy and destabilize global industrial and supply chains. If the U.S. government keeps on suppressing and blocking China's technological development, the U.S. will hurt both itself and others and damage international trade and the global economy. U.S. politicians are weaponizing economic and technological cooperation in an attempt to maintain its absolute technology hegemony. This will stir up a stronger backlash from the business community, both in the U.S. and abroad. According to Reuters, President Joe Biden is expected to issue his long-awaited executive order to screen outbound investment in sensitive technologies to China, according to people familiar with the matter. A White House spokesperson declined to comment. The goal of the order is to prevent U.S. capital and expertise from accelerating the development of technologies that would support China's military modernization and threaten U.S. national security, as it claims. The order is expected to target U.S. private equity, venture capital, and joint venture investments in China in semiconductors, quantum computing, and artificial intelligence. Most investments captured by the order will require that the government be notified about them. Some transactions will be prohibited, sources have said. Coral Hall, a former U.S. Commerce Department official, said, "It fills a gap in our current regime. We have prohibitions on exporting the technology. We have restrictions on inbound investment. This will help to plug that gap on funding and know-how and give the government visibility into these capital flows." According to Reuters, the regulations are not expected to take effect right away, and the administration will solicit comment on its proposals. It has already conducted meetings with stakeholders and has been consulting with allies. The topic also came up last month during U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's meetings with Chinese officials. In a briefing with reporters at the end of her trip, Yellen said the potential restrictions were highly targeted and clearly directed, narrowly, at a few sectors where they have a specific national security concerns, she claimed.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
As-salamu alayka ya Amin Allah fi ardi.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام يا ابن آدم ما كسبت فوق قوتك فأنت فيه خازن لغيرك.
Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salam, said, O son of Adam, whatever you earn beyond your basic needs, you will only keep vigil over it for others.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is a magnificent reflection of the universal persona of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. Imam Ali alayhi salam is the most perfect disciple, the most perfect living miracle of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him. Yes, one of the miracles of the Messenger of Allah is the Holy Quran. This is a silent miracle. And the speaking miracle is Imam Ali alayhi salam. In the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find that His Eminence, the first divinely appointed Imam, he was faced with certain ordeals in his life. Whether it was the usurpation of the Khilafah, or whether it was the loss of his esteemed wife, Lady Fatimatu Zahra, alayha salam, or whether it was the other ordeals that he had to face, his friends betraying him, his companions not supporting him, and many other kind of ordeals. We find, dear friends, that we too are faced with a great many ordeals in our lives. And there's two ways to go about this. We can either become hopeless, despair, become worried, anxious, frustrated, angry, stressed, depressed. This is one way. And this way, before we continue, we must know it is not the correct way to face an ordeal that has come about in our lives. Matter of fact, the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam and the Holy Quran clearly tell us that these are wrong ways to go about dealing with the ordeals that come about in our lives. Matter of fact, in some cases, reacting like this to an ordeal is haram. It is forbidden and it is considered a sin. Case in point, despairing and becoming hopeless. This is one of the great tricks and weapons of Shaitan to make us feel like there is no other help. And in reality, it makes us feel like even the Almighty Allah will not help us through our ordeals. But when we look at the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we see that these ordeals that His Eminence faced, they brought about an opportunity to come closer to the Almighty Allah. And this is precisely why we see Imam Ali alayhi salam speaking to the Almighty Allah, remembering the Almighty Allah, praising the Almighty Allah throughout every single one of his ordeals. It is related, dear friends, in so many of the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, that ordeals that come about upon people are from the Almighty Allah to a large extent. And these specific ordeals which are sent by the Almighty Allah are for the purpose so that we can come closer to Allah, so that we can remember Allah. Perhaps we became stuck in the hustle and bustle of the world, and we started to forget our loving, nourishing Lord. We started to forget the Almighty Allah. And so, the Almighty Allah, out of His forgiveness and mercy and compassion and generosity, He throws a small little ordeal in our path so that our attention once again goes towards Allah. It goes towards the One who loves us the most. It is almost like a call for us to come back to Him. And so, when we are faced with ordeals, the best thing to do, and the recommended thing to do, and the thing which will help us through that ordeal, is to turn to the Almighty Allah. A beautiful lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program To My Brother. This moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
أشهد أنك جاهدت في الله حق جهاده وعملت بكتابه واتبعت سنن نبيه.
I testify that you made utmost efforts, as it should be, in the cause of Allah, acted upon His book, followed the way of life of His Prophet, blessings of Allah be on him and his children, to the last moment of your life, until Allah invited you to come unto Him and used His discretion to take you away and sealed your enemy's doom with the blame that the arguments had been made known to one and all through you. O Allah, let me be happy and satisfied with that which Thou considers good for me. Let me agree with that which Thou decides for me. Let me passionately remember Thee and invoke Thee. Let me be in love with Thy pure and sincere friends. Let me be well-liked and respected on the earth and in the heavens. Let me be unruffled and well-composed in the midst of misfortunes. Let me be gratefully thankful in prosperity. Let me be mindful of much and more bounties. Let me ardently desire for the heart-warming meeting with Thee, well-equipped with piety to gain my end on the day of requital. Let me follow into the footsteps of thy representatives. Let me disassociate myself from the mannerism of thy enemies. Let me pass my time in this world by praising and glorifying thee.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
You know, he was such a kind imam. It's difficult for us to even, you know, comprehend that state. If somebody has been injured, attacked with a sword, which was being soaked for a long time in poison, you know, and then he becomes such that he cannot even walk from masjid to his home. That would be the time where he needs to rest. And this is what the family would want. No visitors, nothing. But we see that during that time of Zarbat and Shahadat, Ali, out of his generosity and his kindness, you know, asked his family to let them come. You know, we have Asbad bin Nubata talking with him. And there were many others who came to see him. There are some, you know, long conversations. Some of them said, "Oh Ali, this will be probably the last time that we hear from you. Can you give us advice?" And so even at the last moment, we see in the time when he is going through pain, you know, he still finds that courage and the commitment to leave messages for us. And this wasiyat specially is done for us. And that is where we have to remember the greatness of Amir al-Mu'mineen. He was indeed a man of people. He was the leader of the people. And he always, you know, wanted to be with the people.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Russian officials are saying that Washington is increasing the risk of a conflict and nuclear tension because of its unusual behavior towards Moscow. They warn that if the U.S. continues its current course of confrontation with Russia, the risk of a nuclear conflict will increase, and the fate of the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty START may be in serious jeopardy. We take a look at the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Russia's Sputnik News Agency has covered this story and tells us more. Former U.S. presidential contender and ex-lawmaker Tulsi Gabbard has slammed U.S. President Joe Biden over his warmongering, charging the octogenarian leader with pushing the world towards a nuclear war over Ukraine. Speaking on Saturday, 1st of July, at a meeting in a university in Centennial in the U.S. state of Colorado, Tulsi Gabbard said the Biden administration's warmongering policy was shoving the world on the brink of a nuclear disaster. She said, "We are faced with the reality. Now President Biden's actions and policies have pushed us to the brink of a nuclear war." The former Democratic lawmaker from Hawaii warned that the U.S.-led proxy war against Russia posed an existential crisis, threatening the very existence of humanity. Tulsi Gabbard said in her speech, which was broadcast on her social media site, "This is an existential crisis not only for us here, but the world. This proxy war against Russia using the Ukrainian people's lives continues to escalate." She insisted that it was time for a reality check to see if President Biden and his backers had any awareness of the risk and dangers of delivering more and deadlier weapons to Ukraine, saying it will only increase the likelihood of a possible direct confrontation between the U.S.-led NATO forces and Russia. Tulsi Gabbard added, "Now, if you hear President Biden and his administration talk about this, they talk about Third World War and nuclear war as though it is just another war, just another conflict. It is so far removed from reality. They are not being honest with the American people what the cost and consequences of these wars would look like." Russia was forced to launch its special operation in Ukraine on 24th of February 2022 as part of its national security measure to protect the Russian motherland against persistent eastern advances and encroachment by US-led NATO military forces. Since the start of Russia's special operation, US-led Western countries have been supplying Kiev with a constant flow of financial and military aid worth tens of billions of dollars. The shipments started with lighter arms and munitions, evolving into bigger artillery guns, artillery shells, munitions and training, which continues with the delivery of heavier weapons, rockets, missiles, armored vehicles, tanks, and possibly F-16 fighter jets. Moscow has repeatedly warned that the Western military assistance to Kiev will only prolong the war and add to the death and destruction without stopping Russia from reaching its security objectives. It has frequently warned the Western side against providing military aid to Ukraine, saying the move amounts to participation in the war. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has issued warnings to them that the NATO allies' numerous attempts at arming and training Ukrainians are tantamount to direct involvement in the war, warning that it sees the Western countries as being complicit to Kiev's warmongers, thus making them legitimate targets for the Russian military forces fighting in the conflict. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Russia's former president Dmitry Medvedev says confrontation with the West will last decades, warning against a quite probable nuclear conflict. Dmitry Medvedev, the deputy head of President Vladimir Putin's Security Council, said in an article published in the government-affiliated newspaper Russiskaya Gazeta that an apocalyptic scenario is not only possible but also quite likely. Medvedev has repeatedly warned that Western support for Ukraine could make the risk of a nuclear conflict irresistible, a conflict Medvedev believes would have no winners. The former Russian president said the potential decades-long conflict could be checked if the two sides engaged in serious negotiations. Medvedev pointed to significant disagreements over Ukraine and the structure of the world order as sources of tension. Dmitry Medvedev said the conflict in Ukraine could become permanent given its existential significance to Moscow. The West has committed to standing by Kiev for as long as necessary, despite warnings from Moscow that the military assistance will only prolong the conflict. He warned that supplying more destructive and advanced weaponry by the United States and its allies to Ukraine increases the probability of a nuclear apocalypse. Dmitry Medvedev said, "And the more destructive these weapons are, the more likely the scenario becomes what is commonly called a nuclear apocalypse." Medvedev also reiterated Moscow's commitment to preventing Ukraine from joining NATO. He said the goal is to eliminate the threat of Ukraine's NATO membership, and Moscow will achieve it one way or another. President Vladimir Putin has also railed against the West for driving NATO's eastward expansion, especially its courting of former Soviet republics such as Ukraine and Georgia. Ukraine was last offered NATO membership in 2008, on the condition that it met the terms set out in a membership action plan.
In the name of God, the Almighty, welcome to this exclusive interview with Iraqi President Abdellatif Rashid. Thank you, Mr. President, and thank you for the opportunity. Mr. President, after years of the war on terror and sectarian war in Iraq, Iraq has once more returned as a natural and historic regional heavyweight. What are the factors that have led to this return? And are we witnessing a new era in Iraq? And can we say that Iraq is in its most advantageous stage since 2003?
First, I would like to thank you for coming. Of course, for us, it is the result of joy and pride in the new role of Iraq. This did not come suddenly or as a reaction. We, the Iraqis, lived long periods of conflicts and even times of war, internal wars and external wars, invasion, terrorism. We suffered from all these issues for a long period of time. It was not a period of months, but rather years, and I dare say decades, where we suffered. As a result of all this, most of the political factions in Iraq, in all sectors, have reached a conviction that we only lose in wars and internal conflicts. Therefore, we have begun to take the path of understanding, discussions, coordination between the political parties. If you recall the time of elections, we finalized the elections, but the formation of the cabinet and the election of a president took a long time. And I believe that this time was beneficial and important for Iraq and for the future of Iraq. And there were agreements between most of the political parties, from the north to the south, from east to west, as well as agreements between the region of Kurdistan and the central government. This has been very beneficial and has led to the election of a president, and the program of the cabinet led to a wider agreement between the political factions. Now, we have implemented the political program and the program of services and the economic program for the country, which it needs. As you know, Iraq has suffered from weak services, bad infrastructure, and its relations with other countries were not good as well. Now, these issues are moving in the right direction. We have better relations now, primarily with all the neighboring countries, and we even have better ties with countries beyond our surroundings. We have good relations with European countries and with the countries of the world, who all welcome the new role of Iraq and the new phase in Iraq. With all these issues, Iraq has witnessed security and tranquility, and because of security and tranquility, we can now implement the program of the cabinet and improve relations among us and between us and the countries of the world.
Well, Iraq has played a pivotal role in bridging the gaps between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Saudi Arab Kingdom. How do you see the significant role of Iraq? And are we witnessing a new regional system or a new political and security map in the region which can be drawn with the new Iraqi role and the states in the region?
I believe this was a very good point and a positive transformation in the security situation. But not only in security, but also cooperation in general in the region. Therefore, I think security in the countries of the region is interlinked, and cooperation between the states is also interlinked. We worked on the steps which we have taken and the following steps. I visited the Islamic Republic of Iran, and the relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia are good. I believe this will strengthen security in the region, and this will lead to strengthening security and stability in the region, as well as the economic situation has also improved, and relations are better, and the role of the region as a whole will be more outstanding and stronger on the global scale.
Also, Iraq is playing an active role in normalizing ties between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Egypt. What are the negotiations that have taken place? How many rounds of talks have taken place? And what are the expectations of these talks between Iran and Egypt? And what would be the impact of this normalization of renewed ties, if it does occur, on the situation as a whole in the region?
I have said that improving ties between all states is necessary, and this is linked to the security aspect, the economic aspect, and even for the social relations. In my opinion, strengthening relations between any two countries in the region will lead to better relations in the whole region in general. It also has a positive impact in the world and would give the region more respect.
Iran has a security concern that armed groups opposed to the Islamic Republic are given haven in Kurdistan and Iraq. How is Iraq dealing with this security concern, where Iran is forced to cooperate militarily with Iraq to deter these military operations against it? And we know that there was a security deal that was signed by Tehran and Baghdad. Is this deal in the stage of implementation, and how can this case be finalized?
The relationship between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Republic of Iraq is very strong, and we coordinate in many sectors, and our cooperation continues even on the security level, and we have a plan to secure all the borders, not only in that region, but all regions, and consultations continue, and practical steps are already being taken. We're with the refugees. As any other country, we sympathize with the refugees. But we do not give the refugees the opportunity to use Iraq as a base to launch attacks or launch an assault against any other country, no matter what. Our policy is clear in this regard, and we are working based on this policy, and we believe this is a good policy between us and the neighboring countries.
Have you begun implementation of the security plan? I mean, the agreement which you've signed.
There have been several meetings, and implementation has begun, and I believe there are security forces present on both sides of the Iraqi-Iranian border.
الجمهورية الإسلامية الإيرانية شريك اقتصادي كبير للعراق
The Islamic Republic of Iran is an important economic partner for Iraq. And it's astute with Iraq and its war against terrorism and against Daesh. There are historic, cultural, and religious ties deeply rooted in the history of the two countries. How can these ties be improved for it to reach the needed stage, and how can all the obstacles facing these ties be removed?
I believe our relationship with the Islamic Republic of Iran has reached a very good stage, and consultations are continuing.